the Chicago Theater of the Air. Produced by Marion Clare, conducted by Robert Trendler, written and directed by Jack LaFondre, Mutual presents radio's greatest hour of music and drama, the famous Chicago Theater of the Air. Tonight's feature production, the ever-popular musical comedy success by Vincent Juman, No No Nanette, starring Virginia Haskins and Bruce Butts, with an all-Chicago dramatic cast headed by Lois Fair and Earl Wilkie. Ladies and gentlemen, the first few minutes of this production will be dedicated to an historic three-continent fact-finding flight being conducted by Colonel Robert R. McCormick, noted historian, outspoken American patriot, and distinguished editor and publisher of the Chicago Tribune. Tonight, by special transcription, Colonel McCormick will speak from Cairo, Egypt. Ladies and gentlemen, Colonel Robert R. McCormick.
Time of the last broadcast did not permit me to give the form a good impression. The approach to the Generalissimo at home presented the most dramatic peacetime picture I've ever seen. It is in the form of a royal hunting lodge, I should say about the size of the late Potter Palmer mansion. Following a straight avenue, we first perceived two horsemen, who on closer approach were seen to be two Moorish cavalrymen on Arab horses. On their heads were octagonal steel spiked helmets. Their robes covered the lower parts of their faces. Reins and accoutrements looked like the Middle Ages. Two flags at the end of the lances, which they dipped in front as we passed by. At the gate of the ground was a group of civil guards with their three-cornered patent leather hats. These men, who for many years have had extraordinary police power, have been apprised of our coming. We were stopped to make sure there was no mistake, and then allowed to proceed. A quarter of a mile beyond were two other Moorish soldiers, in spear helmets, on foot with rifles, with the very arms without the tourniquet. Finally, we came upon a guard turned out for our inspection. Great young men in splendid uniforms with a long overcoat. To my world war eyes, more military than the boyish top suits our men wear today. Climbing up a stairway and through a hall covered with a pretty top.
Ladies and gentlemen, due to transmission difficulties from Cairo, we will interrupt this shortwave broadcast to bring you a studio transcript of Colonel McCormick's remarks as read by the noted radio reporter, John Mello. At the point of substandard transmission quality from Cairo, Colonel McCormick had this to say.
At the gate to the grounds of General Franco's home was a group of civil guards with their three-cornered patent leather hats. These men who for years have had extraordinary police powers had been apprised of our coming. We were stopped to make sure there was no mistake, and then allowed to proceed. A quarter of a mile beyond were two other Moorish soldiers on foot with rifles, who presented arms without detaining us. Finally, we came upon a guard turned out for our inspection. Big young men in splendid uniforms with long coats. To my World War I eyes, more military than the Boy Scout suits our men wear today. Climbing up a stairway and through a hall covered with brilliant tapestries dating from the Spanish ownership of the Netherlands, we were shortly introduced into the presence of the Generalissimo, who in his capacity of Chief of State was in civilian clothes. Last week I told of the interview. As we departed, the guard of honor was dismissed. The Moorish soldiers saluted with great precision as we passed out. These men, Mohammedans, I am told, were chosen not only from the best Moorish soldiers in Africa, but from the best families. The positions rotate, and are considered highly honorable. Many precedents can be found for overseas guards independent of local feeling. There were the Scots archers in France, the French guards of Mary Queen of Scots, the Albanian troops surrounding the King of Greece, the Irish troops of James II, and William and Mary's Dutch and French Huguenot soldiers. The impression at the hunting lodge was one of power and self-assurance. How different it was some years ago when I called on King Alfonso at his massive palace in Madrid. There, following an ancient custom, I first entered the hall of the lowest nobility and passed up room by room through the rank of the hierarchy, saluted at each door by pikesmen in shabby clothes who clashed their halberds on the floor as they had done in the time of Henry V. After a stay at the top of the ladder, in the room of the nobles of the Golden Fleece, presided over by a lady-in-waiting in a costume of bygone days, I was ushered into the presence of the king, an energetic, clever man who, however, could not resist the changing times. An exception to the favorable impression I received in Spain were the pictures of the torturing to death of bulls, a practice that does Spain unutterable harm in the world of public opinion. This illustrates the futility of censorship. Political opinion is suppressed, but this atrocity that horrifies humanity is blazoned to the world. Taking off for a night flight, we passed first over Barcelona and then over Rome, the grandeur that was Rome. The ghosts of the Caesars are grinding their ghostly teeth that their capital has become a checkpoint for airplane flights. The flight plan to Athens said that the temperature would be -6, which I took to be Fahrenheit. In Europe, they use centigrade temperatures so that we were in mild icing conditions. When I commented on this, I was told that whoever controlled our elevation from the Azores put us in the altitude of the worst icing conditions prevailing. This accounted for our rough trip and might have led to an accident. When we come back across the North Atlantic, I hope the same joker will not be on duty. Returning to Athens after 30 years, I only recognized the old palace, much like a New England summer hotel, the stadium, and of course the Acropolis. The Acropolis obviously has not changed. Except for when it was blown up by the Venetians in the 17th century, I do not suppose it has changed since Pericles built it with money from the subject states that should have been used for self-defense and caused the fall of Athens. Wide streets have been built and trees planted, but the streetcars are still the slowest and noisiest found anywhere. The dim electric lights are no better. The ECA, anxious to brief me on its efforts, pointed out the roads it had built, so superior to those of Illinois, and the railroad it had rebuilt with money taxed from American railroads. They showed me plans for irrigation and water power, paid for by money which the pork-seeking states of the South and Southwest will have to forego. Greek food is mixed. The native lamb cannot be surpassed, but the chickens might have flown all the way from Rhode Island. My informants appeared intelligent and were clearly sincere. Like others, they have taken the best jobs they could find and were performing them to the best of their ability. It is at home that the 5%ers are doing the collecting. Our presence in Greece was the work of the English wing of the State Department. The communists had defeated the English and the Greek armies, and the Hitler plan to get control of the Suez Canal route to India was being adopted by the Russians. Now that the army, American trained and led, has driven the bandits out of Greece, the ECA is repairing roads, railroads, and bridges which the Germans have destroyed in their retreat. When the avenues of invasion have all been opened again, it may need an American army, and not merely American leaders, to hold the Isles of Greece. The State Department plan to use the American Army to protect this British pipeline was, of course, backed by the beneficiaries of ECA expense, just as formerly when the Russian wing of the State Department was in control. They backed the shipping of arms to Russia. Whatever wing of the State Department is in the ascendancy, the five percenters profit. How futile it has all been is perceived when we see Egypt, India, Ceylon, and Thailand all free, and the Suez Canal of no further use to a vanishing empire. Another result unintended by the English wing of the State Department is the Americanization of the Greeks by the example of our American colony. These thoroughly patriotic and thoroughly American people are teaching the Greeks a way of life they could not have learned otherwise. The Army has shown them the power of the Republic. The Navy, also in the Mediterranean to protect the lifeline to India, points out to the nations along its shores that Columbia rules the waves. As I talked with our men and women, I perceived a great truth. The whole life of our nation has been the pushing out of a frontier. The actors were often ignorant of what they were doing in their course of manifest destiny. The elaborate plans under a clever deception to return our republic to European control are defeating themselves. The republic is pushing forward in Europe. And so as I take off across the ancient battlefields, I recall the words of Byron. The mountains look on Marathon, and Marathon looks on the sea. And musing there an hour alone, I dreamed that Greece might still be free. No story of Greece could be complete without a prominent mention of King Paul and Queen Frederica. Their charm does not need royal raiment to build it up. The king served gallantly in the World War, and both he and the queen have incurred real danger in combating the bandits. However, I am told that their influence, added to the power of the law-abiding fragment of the population, would be insufficient to oppose the communists without American military assistance. Seeing these charming members of a vanishing order, one thinks of the words of Malcolm about the death of Cawdor. Nothing in his life became him like the leaving it. I recall that at the outbreak of World War I, every country in Europe excepting France and Switzerland was a monarchy. And this brings to mind Clifford Raymond's immortal prophecy. Here is Mr. Raymond's editorial, The Twilight of the Kings, published in the Tribune on August 2nd, 1914. Before establishing hell on earth, the pietistic kings commend their subjects to God, seek the Lord's sanction for the devil's work. And now I commend you to God, said the Kaiser from his balcony to the people in the street. Go to church and kneel before God and pray for his help for your gallant army. Pray that a farmer dragged from a Saxon field shall be speedier with a bayonet thrust than a winemaker taken from his wines in the Ob. That a Berlin lawyer shall be steadier with a rifle than a Moscow merchant. That a machine gun manned by Heidelberg students shall not jam, and that one worked by Paris carpenters shall. Pray that a Bavarian hop grower, armed in a quarrel in which he has no heat, shall outmarch a wheat grower from Poltava. That Cossacks from the Don shall be lured into barbed wire entanglements and caught by masked guns. That an innkeeper of Salzburg shall blow the head off a baker from the Loire. Go to church and pray for help. That the hell shall be hotter in innocent Ardennes than it is in equally innocent Hessen. That it shall be hotter in innocent Kovno than in equally innocent Posen. And the pietistic Tsar commends his subjects to God, that they may have strength of arm in a quarrel they do not understand, that they may inflict more sufferings than they are required to endure, and the name of Romanov be greater than the name of Hohenzollern, that it may be greater than the name of Habsburg, that its territory shall be wider, and the territories of Hohenzollern and the territories of Habsburg less. The pietistic emperor of Austria commends his subjects to God to seek divine assistance to crush the peasants of Serbia, dragged from the wheat field when it was ready for the scythe, and given to the scythe themselves. This is, we think, the last call of monarchy upon divinity when Asmodeus walks in armor. The kings worship Baal and call it God. But out of the sacrifice will come, we think, a resolution firmly taken to have no more wheat growers and growers of corn, makers of wine, miners and fishers, artisans and traders, sailors and storekeepers, offered up with prayer to the Almighty in a feudal slaughter, armed against each other without hate and without cause they know, or if they know, would not give a penny which way it was determined. This is the twilight of the kings. Western Europe of the people may be caught in this debacle, but never again. Eastern Europe of the kings will be remade, and the name of God shall not give grace to 100 square miles of broken bodies. If divinity enters here, it comes with a sword to deliver the people from the sword. It is the twilight of the kings. The Republic marches east in Europe.
Speaking from the stage of the Chicago Theater of the Air, the noted radio reporter John Mello has read a transcript of a speech broadcast from Cairo, Egypt, by Colonel Robert R. McCormick, editor and publisher of the Chicago Tribune, who is on an historic three-continent fact-finding flight. Free copies of this shortwave address may be obtained by writing to the Mutual Broadcasting System, Chicago 11, Illinois. Now the curtain rises on tonight's Chicago Theater of the Air production of the great musical comedy success by Vincent Humann's No, No, Nanette, starring Virginia Haskins and Bruce Foote, and conducted by Robert Trendler. No, No, Nanette. In the well-appointed music room of a fashionable New York apartment, a lonely and obviously unhappy young lady sits at the keyboard of a grand piano. As her nimble fingers run idly over the keys, she gives voice to her despair.
A protege. They call me a protege. Just because I play the piano and sing, no one seems to think I'm human. But I am human. Of course I appreciate Mr. and Mrs. Smith taking me into their home and giving me a chance to develop my music. But even an orphan girl can dream.
No, no, Nanette. I know exactly what you're thinking, and you're much too young for that sort of thing.
Too young? Will I always be too young for love and the things I'm thinking about?
Good heavens! Whatever put such ideas in your mind? No, no, Nanette. No, no.
No, no, Nanette. That's all I hear. I get it the whole day through. No, no, Nanette. It's in my ear. No matter what I may do. Sometimes, perhaps, I'll have my way. When I am old and turning gray. But just as yet,
not so wise, so don't get wild, dear, when you can have your own sweet way.
I'll have my own sweet way, and a word to say, but wait till someday. I shall wear expensive dresses, I shall even bob my tresses, I shall go to grand cafes to dine.
Nanette, be careful, be not careful.
I'll order caviar and baby wine. All the world and all that's in it I shall know. And every minute I'll be busy buying furs and frills.
Nanette, you're raving, you should be saving.
I'll find a Santa Claus who'll be the king.
No, no, Nanette, that's all you hear. The whole day through. No, no, Nanette, it's in your ear, no matter what you may do.
In the living room of the apartment, a young man is calling on Nanette's guardian, Mrs. James Smith.
Mrs. Smith, may I have a word with you, please?
Why, of course, Tom, of course.
I've come to see you as a representative of the committee.
Really? What committee?
A committee of Nanette's friends who want her to come to Atlantic City for the weekend.
No, no, Tom, that's out of the question.
But why, Mrs. Smith? Don't you trust Nanette with me?
I don't trust Nanette with herself. Tom, you can't possibly know as much as I know about the things that go on in a young girl's mind.
Oh, I'd like to know. Believe me, I would.
Life is full of temptations, Thomas, but we must set them aside in favor of more noble thoughts.
Someone warily, charily,
we're always
beckoning, beckoning me to join their dancing. When the sea begins a calling me, a sort of tempting incantation fills me with elation.
This is the same.
The song of love's sweet fascination. Something fills me with a thousand thrills when the sea is calling me.
Oh, when the sea begins a calling me, a sort of tempting incantation.
Mrs. Smith is genuinely concerned over Nanette's welfare, and she confides her feelings to her maid, Pauline.
Oh, dear Pauline, these young people are getting to be more of a problem all the time.
You ain't such an old goat, Miss Smith.
Pauline.
Well, you ain't. Everything you got is young yet if you just hitch it up and tuck it in the right places.
Pauline, of all the things to say, I simply won't have a servant of mine talking like that.
And your husband, Mr. Jimmy. He ain't no dried-up old mummy. When he lives with the young gals, he got a look in his eye that he ain't no mistaking. Woo!
Why, of all the disrespectful, Mr. Smith is the pillar of respectability. He's always been a one-girl man.
Yes, him. One at a time. One at a time.
But there's no keeping young lovers apart. Now we find Tom entering the music room by way of the terrace.
Nanette. Nanette, may I come in?
Tom, if someone sees you coming in through the terrace...
No one's going to see me, Nanette. I just left your guardian in the living room.
What did she say? As if I didn't know.
She doesn't think a weekend at the beach is safe for a young girl.
Is anything safe for a young girl?
Well, not when she happens to be you and I happen to be me.
Oh, Tom, when you talk like that, your words are like an artist's brush painting a beautiful picture.
Picture you upon my knee. Just tea for two and two for tea. Just me for you and you for me alone. Nobody near us to see us or hear us. No friends or relations on weekend vacation. We won't have it long, dear, that we ought to telephone.
Boys to sing. We will raise
me.
Come to see how happy we
I've planned it, you must understand it. It's yours to command it, please do.
All that you say I'm admiring, it's worth desiring, but can't you see? I'd like to wait, dear, for some future date, dear. It won't be too late, dear, for me.
Just me for you and you for me alone.
Nobody near us to see us or hear us.
No friends or relations on weekend vacation.
We won't have it known, dear, that we all care.
Us to wait outside.
Oh,
are you coming with us or aren't you?
I'm afraid I can't make it this time, Marjorie. I had another engagement over the weekend. You run along, Tom.
Oh, Nanette, believe me, someday I'll give you everything in the world you want most.
All I ask for is happiness, Tom. Is that asking too much?
Oh, you couldn't ask too much, Nanette.
I want to be happy, but I won't be happy till I make you happy too.
Life's really worth living when we are mirth-giving. Why can't I give some to you?
When skies are gray and you say you are blue, I'll send the sun smiling through.
I want to be happy, but I won't be happy till I make you happy too.
I'm a very ordinary man, trying to work out life's happy plan, doing unto others as I'd like to have them doing unto me.
Smiling faces everywhere. Surely I deserve my little share. I'm a lucky girl, so that I can get it all from you.
I want to be happy, but I won't be happy till I make you happy too. I see the world when we are
first
in,
why can't I
give
some to you?
When skies are
clear,
say you are
blue. I'll send the sun smiling through.
I won't be happy, but I won't be happy.
understands girls. I'm sure he'd let me go if he were here.
Oh, well, if Mr. Smith knows so much about girls, how did he happen to marry Mrs. Smith?
She might have been different when she was young.
Oh, she's not so old.
I know, but she has a complex.
Complex?
She thinks too many romantic affairs are like too many moths. They'll eventually quench the flame.
Oh, well, from what I've heard of her husband's affairs, Mrs. Smith may be right.
In an early childhood day, when December seemed like May, ring around the rosy with the boys I used to play. Tommy, Andy, Harold, Joe ate my candy, then would go. I tried to please them all, you know. That's why not one became my foe. Too many rings around Rosie never get Rosie on me. Too many bows when she should have one.
Another part of the spacious apartment, we find Mr. James Smith welcoming a visitor into his den. The visitor is a lawyer by profession, and Mr. Smith seems desperately in need of his legal counsel.
Billy, thank heaven Sue didn't see you come in.
What's up, Jim? Why this secret conference in your den?
Well, Billy, you're a poor man, aren't you?
I am a lawyer. I don't answer questions like that.
Just how far would you go for, say, $5,000?
$5,000? Oh, another woman?
Three women.
Dad, I didn't think you had it in you. Congratulations.
Lay off, old man. If my wife ever finds out...
I'm quite aware of Mrs. Smith's idiosyncrasies. Where are these women?
Boston, Washington, and San Francisco.
Brother, you cover a lot of territory.
Don't get me wrong. I simply made it possible for three very attractive and deserving young ladies to enjoy the good things in life with perfect propriety.
Perfect propriety? Oh, sure. Every man's entitled to a harem.
Bill, if you're going to talk to me like that...
I apologize. Go ahead.
Easy on that word, harem. We'd better whisper the rest of this interview.
Is it that bad?
Well, first there's Betty from Boston.
Betty from Boston?
She was the happy inspiration of a chance meeting on a Fall River boat.
Chance meeting?
I said chance!
You also said we'd whisper.
Yes. I was on my way to our Boston branch, and the poor child had lost her purse.
Uh-oh. Approach number three.
She said she wanted to study art, but she had an unnatural sort of a father who was forcing her to marry a man three times her age and who was about to foreclose a mortgage on the farm.
And just before she met you, she was about to end it all by jumping into the cruel, icy waters of the river.
How did you know?
I'm psychic.
Well, thank heavens I saved her. I opened some charge accounts for Betty, set her up in a place to live. And she's in a fair way of becoming a great artist.
She is a great artist.
Hmm?
What about the others? Who are they?
Well, there's Winnie from Washington, and Flora from Frisco. Winnie used to be in the Follies, but...
Never mind the heart-rending details. Is this case in my hands?
Well, of course. That's why I...
All right, then. Now, I want you to phone these girls today. Tell them to leave immediately and meet you at your cottage in Atlantic City. It's all right. Tell your wife you have to make a business trip, and we'll meet the girls there. Just leave it to me to make a settlement and cross them off your books.
But if Sue ever finds out...
There won't be any danger of that. We'll handle this thing legally and above board. Just leave everything to me.
Well, Nanette.
Surprised to find me in your car, Uncle Jimmy?
Yes, I must admit I am. Sorry, I can't take you riding, Nanette, but I'm going on a business trip.
I happen to know where you're going.
What?
I heard you and your attorney mentioned Atlantic City.
Did you mention this to Aunt Sue?
Not yet. I won't be any trouble, Uncle Jimmy. I'm just dying to go to Atlantic City.
Here, Nanette, take this $200 and go shopping or something.
Well, thank you. I'll shop at Atlantic City.
Well, it isn't proper for us to... that is, I'm not your legal uncle.
There'll be plenty of chaperones at the cottage, won't there?
Did you overhear that, too?
You should have thicker walls in your den, Uncle Jimmy.
By Jove, you force a strong argument, Nanette. It looks as though I have a passenger for Atlantic City.
Space in musical comedy involved nothing more than a mere shifting of scenery. We now find a boardwalk and an ocean before us and realize that we're in Atlantic City along with Nanette and the rest of her friends.
What a piece of a girl she is charming. What a piece of a piece he will be. Every boy I'll bet when he sees Nanette forget what he came to the sea. Each man is amused and alarming for the dance of the season to see. And you scarcely know where you'll
Nanette on the beach for the moment, let's look in on the Smith Atlantic City cottage, where Mr. James Smith is being soundly counseled by his counsel.
Look, Jimmy, we're here to settle things with three women you've already gotten yourself involved with. Bringing Nanette down here to this cottage was the worst thing you could have done. The girl is your wife's protege.
Well, and if... Well, I'm telling you for the tenth time, Billy, it wasn't my idea.
What if your wife starts to look for her? What then?
Well, that's why I hired you. You're supposed to straighten everything out. I could have engaged Kirikov, you know.
And who's Kirikov?
Oh, a specialist with women. Only trouble is, he's got a waiting list.
Believe me, Jim, if I didn't need the money, I could find easier and safer cases than this.
Oh, here's number one. Get out your law books, boy.
Well, anyway, one at a time will be easier to handle.
Evening, gentlemen.
Oh, Pauline.
I overheard you gentlemen saying you was coming down here to Atlantic City. So I thought I'd come down and see if I could be of service.
But what about Mrs. Smith? Did you tell her?
I didn't tell her nothing yet. I just said I was taking some time off she owed me. I thought maybe Miss Nanette would be glad to see me.
What do you mean you didn't tell Mrs. Smith anything yet?
There's quite a few things I'm needing, Mr. Smith.
Well, Pauline, you just go out in front of some of the shops, and you have as much as smile at anything. I'll buy it for you.
I think I'll stand in front of a jewelry store and have a stick.
Enough of Mr. Smith's problems for the moment. Now back to the beach and Nanette.
Nanette, you at Atlantic City after all. Did the Smiths come down?
Huh? The Smiths?
Yes.
Of course not, Tom. What makes you think that?
I thought I saw the car in the driveway of the cottage.
Oh, no. That belongs to a real estate agent. He's calling to see if the cottage is for rent this season.
Oh, I see. Well, where are you staying?
Oh, with Marjorie and the girls at the hotel. Aunt Sue gave me permission at the last moment.
I see. Well, the important thing is you're really here. Perhaps at last you'll tell me what I'm waiting to hear.
Please, Tom, wait just a little longer.
How much longer will you keep me waiting? Don't you think that you're a bit unkind?
Marriage is a thing that needs debating before or after you find.
Don't keep me waiting and waiting for you. It's such a fool thing to do.
Married life, they say, is oh so pleasant. And you know there's no time like the present. Every lost moment and each hour's delay
is throwing our heaven away. Just keep on waiting for you. Every lost moment and each hour's delay is throwing our heaven away.
Young lovers.
neighbors for a moment. We're, you've guessed it, back at the cottage.
The door, Pauline. Answer the door. As long as you're here, protect your poor employer.
You sure got the whim-whams, Mr. Smith. And that spells women.
How do you do? Is Dada here?
Huh? Is who Dada here?
Dada. I mean, does Jimmy Smith live here?
He do.
Well, didn't Mr. Smith say he was expecting me?
He didn't say nothing.
But I'm Betty. Betty from Boston.
Pleased to meet you. I'm Pauline from Peoria.
Hello. Does Jimmy Smith live here?
Yes, he does.
Well, I'm Winnie from Washington, and I had a message from Uncle Jimmy to come here.
Say, just a minute. I think you pressed the wrong button.
Oh, no. He's expecting me. I've got a wire.
Well, you needn't look so flossy about that. I have one, too.
Imagine that. Two of them.
Say, is that another one?
No, that's the maid. I think she was engaged for me.
More probably for me.
You're both wrong. I was engaged for Miss Nanette.
Nanette?
That makes three. Just wait till I get my hands on Dada.
Well, what's number three like?
Very small and built like a wristwatch. And besides that, he's got a regular wife.
What?
A very saving little woman. She can make a full meal out of a soup bone. I beg your pardon. I'm Flora from Frisco.
Oh, another.
I have a wire from my Jamesy. Will you tell him I'm here, please? Don't this beat all? King Solomon didn't have nothing on our Mr. Jimmy.
Where's Uncle Jimmy, Pauline? I've got to see him.
Uh-oh. The wristwatch has arrived.
I beg your pardon.
Just stand in line, honey. I'll tell his nibs the harem ever assembled.
Just a moment, ladies. Don't be hasty. As Mr. Smith's legal counsel, I'll transact all business. Well, at last it's all settled, Jimmy. I got rid of that Betty from Boston, that Winnie from Washington, and that zebra from Frisco.
Oh, isn't it wonderful? And Sue will never know. From now on, there's no one but my wife in my life.
But it cost you $150,000.
Well, I'll make it back in 2 years. I'll economize. I'll write my correspondence on thinner paper.
I'm afraid you'll have to make a great deal more than that, Jimmy.
Uh-huh. Oh, Sue.
Since my maid, my husband, and my protege are all down here, I thought I might as well join my family.
That dress, those furs. Sue, you look a million.
My bills won't add up to quite that much, but almost.
Pauline, did you...
Don't look at me. I didn't say nothing. I got scruples. You overlooked Tom, Jimmy.
Tom? Yes, Tom. I thought it was strange that Nanette was down here after Mr. Smith's refusal to let her come. Mr. Smith, if you think you can run off of my girl, you've got another...
Tom, please. It was all my idea.
Your idea? Didn't Mr. Smith buy you oceans of bathing suits and everything else contemptible?
Well, I didn't buy her the ocean. They were using it that day.
Answer me, Nanette. Answer me one question. Are you a good woman or are you not?
Well, I'm not sure. I took $200 from a married man.
It's a great consolation to know the worst.
If I had a toy balloon, I'd brain him.
Nanette, I've got a job, and I'll pay him $10 a week.
What for?
I'll win back her honor by installments.
Tom, my boy... Is there anything in that bright lexicon of yours that prevents your accepting $200 from me?
Certainly not. That's man to man.
Well, here's the $200.
Thank you. Here's the $200 back. You're paid in full.
Well, that's a relief. Now, if I could just manage to pay for all the gorgeous paraphernalia my wife is wearing.
Oh, you can, Jim.
What do you know about my financial affairs?
Plenty. Here's $150,000 I got back from those women. That Betty from Boston and Winnie from Washington.
Sue, you don't mean they gave it to you?
It wasn't difficult. They had to admit that I had a very good blackmail case against them.
Blackmail? Why didn't you think of that, Billy? I'm an attorney. How do you expect me to think of anything that simple? Oh, Sue, my dear, what would I ever do without you?
Don't ever try, Jimmy Smith.
From now on, I'm Betty from Boston, Winnie from Washington, Flora from Frisco, and Sue from Sioux City, all wrapped up in one.
Billy, you're fired. I've taken on permanent legal counsel.
Happy, Nanette.
Mm-hmm.
Forgive me for doubting you.
Uh-huh. On one condition.
Any condition. Just name it.
Don't ever say, no, no, Nanette, Tom.
Oh, my darling. How can I say no to anything you suggest? Got any ideas?
Well...
Don't be bashful, honey. If you ain't got no ideas, I'll give you plenty.
I want to be happy, but I won't be happy till I make you happy too.
Life's really worth living when we are mirth giving. Why can't I give some to you?
When skies are gray and you say you are blue, I'll send the sun smiling too.
I want to be happy, but I won't be happy till I make you happy too.
When skies are gray and you say you are blue,
I'll send the sun smiling on my knee, just tea for two and two for tea, just me for you and you for me alone.
No friends, no relations, on weekend vacations, we won't have it lonely.
by Robert Sandler. The Chicago Theater of the Air has presented No, No, Nanette by Vincent Dunham, starring Virginia Haskins and Bruce Foote. Featured speaker was Colonel Robert R. McCormick, editor and publisher of the Chicago Tribune. Performance rights were granted by the Thames Whitmark Music Library. Heard in synchronized speaking roles tonight, the following members of the Chicago Theater of the Air chorus: Lois Fair as Nanette, Earl Wilkie as Tom, Flora Patterson as Sue, Max Wilson as Jim, Arwin Schweig as the lawyer, Emma K. Bowers as Pauline, Kathleen Carnes as Betty, Ruth Bowers as Winnie, and Ruth Slater as Flora. A studio transcript of Colonel McCormick's interrupted shortwave address from Cairo was read by John Mallow. This is Lee Bennett cordially inviting you to next week's Chicago Theater of the Air production, Leon Cavallo's dynamic grand opera favorite, I Pagliacci, starring Nancy Carr and Richard Tucker. This is the Mutual Broadcasting System.